From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Borlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss China's expansion and development throughout Southeast Asia and beyond, and whether or not they're becoming more audacious in their global development.
Yes, we have seen China take these steps, trying to exert their influence, trying to push their economy even further out.
Then I'll talk with Barak Barfi, a research fellow at the New America Foundation who spent his career studying Arab and Islamic affairs. We'll discuss political development in Libya since the Arab Spring Revolution.
It's between those who benefited from Gaddafi's patronage and were given positions in the government, were given influence, given access, versus those who did not have it.
Tracing the political and social divides in the Middle East, coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. Rebecca Cruz, we're going to take that infamous pivot to Asia and talk about China this week, as it's been in the news a lot, not all of it very flattering news. But let's look at what China's trying to do around the world, expanding its empire, if you will. So investment in Brazil, tens of billions of dollars. China is now investing in Brazil, either investing or loaning funds to Brazil to engage in certain industries, energy, banking, agriculture, and particularly transportation. I guess they have sights on building, using Chinese companies to build a transcontinental railway that goes through the Amazon. So there's a lot of talk about this, the impact it has on Brazil, if it's really going to help their economy at all. We know they're struggling. Or if this is really all about China and boosting their companies, boosting China's position and power in Latin America. Is there one side or another on this?
It's probably both. We have talked on the show before about how Brazil is struggling right now. Their economy is still not recovered from the recent blows that they've had. And China, of course, sees this as an opportunity. So this is mutually beneficial to both. Brazil is able to get some of these funds to help build their infrastructure. And China is able to be a loaner to well, at least what was until recently a rising country and could certainly be again. And yes, we have seen China take these steps. And I know you've got some other examples of trying to exert their influence, trying to push their economy even further out. So this is not a surprise, and in many ways, it makes a lot of sense for both countries.
Well, so other examples, as you mentioned, fishing off the coast of West Africa. So China has reportedly depleted a lot of its fishing stocks near its own coasts. So it's now reaching out into other parts of the world, trying to fish in other places. Greenpeace, the environmental activist organization, has accused China of engaging in not so ecologically sound fishing practices off of the West African coast, where you find a lot of weak governments that can't really enforce rules and regulations regarding fishing. So another instance of China overstepping its bounds, if you will, and kind of thumbing their nose at international laws, regulations, and taking advantage of weak countries.
You could certainly look at it that way, that they are taking advantage of the opportunity. But in other ways, they are also forced to do this because, as has been argued, they have depleted their own resources and are looking to go elsewhere. And this seems to be a prime spot. I think that the situation with Brazil, you mentioned that they're going to be going through some rainforests and some other areas. This situation, where we're talking about what is fairly largely recognized as bad fishing practices. And then the other situation, which we've talked about on the show before, where they are building these islands or extending islands into the South China Sea. These have security implications, but they also have kind of the human cost or the environmental security implications as well, that these are significant projects that they are undertaking that are potentially affecting the environment in very, very significant ways. And the consequences surely are going to be felt around the world, not just in these areas that they're acting in.
Well, one last story about China this week. Six Chinese scientists were actually indicted in the United States. So back to this country, the United States, using its Economic Espionage Act, indicted six Chinese scientists, suggesting that they were basically stealing microchips, in particular cell phone chips, from the work that they're doing here in the U.S. and selling them to commercial enterprises and also to the military in China. And of course, they have no permission to do this. So, you know, what's interesting about that case is that this was widely reported in China, and the Chinese response has been rather amusing. It's made these six scientists actually quite famous in China for having achieved this kind of recognition, I guess, for engaging in this type of activity. What are we to make of that?
Well, this, of course, is part of the larger issue of kind of cybersecurity, computer espionage, which has gone back and forth, particularly between these two countries. These are the big countries in terms of influence around the world today. They are the big countries in terms of the technology available. And this sort of thing has likely been going on for some time. And this case has become very well known. And yes, the folks in China are becoming heroes. But I don't think that this is a huge surprise to anyone there or to anyone within our own government. And I think this does, again, speak to this bigger issue of China really exerting itself. And because it has become in the last decade or two decades a major political power, certainly an economic power, but more a political power, this has become a concern. The other thing that happened this week is that we had our U.S. Military flying over these islands that I mentioned before, and they were warned more than eight times by the Chinese military. So this potentially could turn into a larger conflict between China and the United States. That is the concern. But China keeps pushing the boundaries, and there's going to be some reaction, and our government is obviously becoming more and more concerned.
Well, clearly these are very alarmist reports, and like I said, not all that flattering. Maybe signs for the future as to what's coming between our two countries, but come on, a lot of us do these sorts of things, right? It's not just China. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here this week, as always.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. Send us a tweet at WorldViewsKGOU or at Suzette Gorlot and at Cruz226. You can also leave your comments on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. While you're there, you'll find a link to download our podcast. After a short break, New America Foundation Fellow Barak Barfi explains Libya's progression since the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution and how the interests of Middle East regional powers are affecting the war in Syria. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Today I'm joined by Barak Barfi, a research fellow at the New America Foundation who specializes in Arab and Islamic affairs. His analyses of Middle Eastern politics, society, and conflicts have been published in numerous national and international news sources. He has also testified before Congress about al-Qaeda and the ongoing conflict in Syria. Barak Barfi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
Barak, all of your experience in the Middle East. You've lived in the Middle East for many years, off and on. You've done much work there in terms of your writing and journalism, many publications outlining all of the issues that we are dealing with in the region currently. But I'd like to start with your work specifically in Libya. Libya seems to have, you know, fallen off the front pages. We don't really pay much attention to it anymore. Everything, of course, is focused on Syria in particular these days and has been for some time, back to Iraq, the whole ISIS situation. I want to get there, too. But let's start with Libya, because things are still concerning with Libya. You know, a case where the United States was involved, other European players involved. We had regime change. Then what happened? And kind of where are we today in terms of Libya's progress and stability in the region?
Well, when the Libyan revolution ended, when Gaddafi was killed in September 2011, basically the NATO and Western powers withdrew. They turned it over to the UN. They had a UN mission there, and they were in an advisory capacity and not in a executive capacity where they could do something, they could do some directives. So that's the big problem there. The politicians were not well-placed or well-positioned to build a new state. Gaddafi destroyed all the state institutions. He monopolized power in the hands of a small coterie of followers. So these people didn't have the political experience necessary, and they faced a very fragmented population. And over time, it became worse. Islamists became more prevalent. And that led to this Khalifa, General Khalifa Haftar's Operation Dignity in May 2014, pitched as a battle against Islamists. But it's not an Islamist versus non-Islamist conflict. It's not an ideological conflict. It's a conflict between those who benefited under Gaddafi and lost out versus those who benefited from the revolution. And that's where we are today.
And when you say benefited, just to be clear, you mean benefited financially, benefited politically, I mean had voice in society, had a higher standard of living, that it was more kind of a class or a haves and have-nots society instead of an Islamic, you know, ideological thing? Or, I mean, is that what you mean by those who benefited and those who didn't?
Well, there are no classes in Libya. Libya only has about 6.5 million people, and they produced pre-war, I think, 1.6 million barrels of oil a day, which makes them a very wealthy state. So everybody's middle class. It's between those who benefited from Gaddafi's patronage and were given positions in the government, were given influence, given access, versus those who did not have it. And those who did not have it, specifically from the city of Misrata, have now taken over. And we see tribes such as the Warfala from Beni Walid, which is the largest tribe in the country. They provided the security backbone of the country. They've lost out. They actually were the last holdout after Tripoli fell. So these are the fault lines in society.
So before we get to the fault lines in other societies and how we might distinguish the way in which you're characterizing the situation in Libya from, let's say, how it is in Syria, let's talk about the involvement of external players here in Libya. So you mentioned about how it was turned over to UN actors and kind of having UN oversight. What is the role right now of international actors? Are they, you know, the United States, the European players? Are there people on the ground? Is there a significant amount of attention being paid, at least maybe not, again, on the front pages, but in some way, shape or form, people are there engaging with Libyans and trying to guide them along these lines in terms of, you know, redeveloping their society in a way that is beneficial to everyone within that society?
The United States really doesn't have a lot of interest in Libya. Libya's chief export is oil. In 1982, President Reagan cut off oil supplies from purchases of oil supplies from Libya, so we stopped purchasing them. The major player in Libya is Italy, the colonial power. They get most of their natural gas from Libya. They have investments there. The British and the French were at the forefront of the NATO effort to overthrow, to topple Gaddafi. So those are the three countries that really have a lot of interests on the Western side. On the Arab side, we see a proxy contest between Qatar and Turkey on one side supporting the Islamists and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and to a lesser extent Egypt on the other supporting General Haftar. So those are the fault lines of the outside powers.
That's Barak Barfi, a scholar of Arab and Islamic affairs at the New America Foundation. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Today, I'm speaking with Middle East scholar Barak Barfi. When we left off, he described the fault lines among external state actors like Italy, Britain, and France regarding Libya's future. So now let's think about those fault lines then and migrate a little bit to Syria. You spent quite a bit of time studying this issue as well. Characterize for us that situation as opposed to what's going on in Libya and how, we have some of the same issues, obviously, affecting society in both countries, but some very different ones as well in terms of the Islamic State, of Syria and Iraq and the Levant, and how that is challenging us in a very different way in terms of the involvement of the United States and other external players.
Well, in Syria, the fault lines are much clearer and they're much more sectarian based. You have what's shaping up to be a Sunni-Shi'i conflict, with the Shi'i power being Iran supporting Syria, whose rulers are part of an Alawite sect, which is actually a Shi'i offshoot They're on one side supported by Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia organization, versus the Sunni powers, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the big players who are supporting the rebel groups, and Turkey as well, whose prime minister was the first to call for President Bashar al-Assad of Syria to go.
So it sounds to me, as I'm hearing you talk about, you know, Libya and then Syria, that you can kind of stack people in the region up. You're either supporting this or you're supporting that, that it seems very black and white. Is that really kind of the accurate portrayal of it, is that these people are supporting this group and these, you know, countries or governments are supporting this group, and that it's pretty clear, those fault lines are pretty clear? I mean, it sounds like they're more clear in one place than another, but it sounds like they're, you know, they're all kind of taking sides, and that contributes to the significant complexity in the region.
On a macro level, that's certainly true. But on a more micro, local level, you see splits between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Qatar's funding Islamist groups, in some cases extremist Islamic groups, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which was a Salafi organization. The Salafis are very puritanical. They want to return to the first three centuries of Islam. We believe that they've been funding Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, whereas Saudi Arabia is trying to find people that are more moderate on the Syrian ideological spectrum and have less extreme Islamist views.
Can I ask about Turkey? We've obviously seen Turkey struggle a bit with this issue and how and disagreements between Turkey and the United States and others about how to deal with these problems. But here you have Syria on its southern border. You know, Turkey, the Turkish government clearly wants one thing to happen in Syria, but yet the United States seems to be, you know, moving in a different direction. So you have that split or that fault line as well. But this Kurdish issue, obviously, the Kurds in the northern part of Syria and the incursions across that border into Turkey, and how all of this is shaping up to even further complicate an already difficult situation.
Well, Turkey, as I stated, Prime Minister Erdogan was the first to call for Bashar al-Assad to go, and he was willing to use all means necessary to do that. And what that meant is he turned a blind eye to the jihadists using Turkey as a logistical base to cross into Syria. In recent months, they've clamped down on that. Turkey has other problems as well. It has a big Kurdish problem that it's been able to minimize for some time under Erdogan. However, it's come to the fore again because the Syrian Kurdish organization known as the PYD is an offshoot of the Turkish Kurdish Workers Party known as the PKK, and considered a terrorist organization by Turkey and the United States. So he's worried that he'll have a PKK haven on his border. Those fears have been unfounded, but he's also worried about a Kurdish nationalism being brought to the fore. We know that in Iraq they've carved out an autonomous area. If they do that in Syria, what will Turkey's Kurds do?
So let me just explore a little bit further some of the kind of ways in which all of these things have happened. I mean, when you look at, as you've so nicely described, all of the various fault lines and the issues and all of the complex nature of this and where people stand on, you know, where different players stand on the issues. But overall, throughout this region, are there some similarities? I've heard other analysts, for example, talk about how you know, the Arab world right now is facing all of these difficulties because of several pressures coming all at one time. You have the political pressures, the lack of political voice, the fact that you have a large segment of society that don't have any role to play in their governance, in their daily lives. So kind of political voice. You have obviously lots of economic issues and economic problems and unemployment and poverty and environmental concerns. I mean, you just look at Syria alone, right? We have environmental issues at play there, and drought and troubles over who gets what land. And, you know, same thing in the Palestinian-Israeli situation and case. You know, demographics with the youth bulge. I mean, so this entire region seems to be facing all of these pressures, where some countries, as they've developed, have maybe faced one or two of these pressures at one time. It seems like this region has really come under all of these pressures at one time. And is that, you know, a kind of an accurate portrayal in terms of how these analysts are suggesting we have to understand all of these conflicts within that context of all of the stuff happening at once and all of the very difficult, you know, measures that have to be undertaken, and how external players and parties just really don't know how to deal with it?
Arab states have really failed at development vis-a-vis other countries in the third world, chief among them economic development. Egypt was one of the richest countries in the non-Western world at the beginning of the 20th century, yet its GDP, per capita GDP, lags far beyond countries such as South Korea and Taiwan, which developed much later, and even the South American countries. On the political front, we haven't seen any type of liberalization that we saw in Latin America. In the 80s, we had military juntas ruling those countries. Now most of them are democratic. We look at women's empowerment issues. They lag far beyond most third world countries in that as well. So they face an array of problems because they've basically failed at what they were supposed to do. And leaders have just tried to hold on to power and do what they can to do that, empowering a crony elite class, dedicating 2% of their gross domestic product to food subsidies. That erodes all types of – creates all types of economic problems. So across the spectrum, we see this.
Well, we have to end, hopefully, on an optimistic note. Can we try at least? I mean, is there something we can take away from the experiences we're having today based on your time there, what you can tell us about this region, your analysis? What is there to be optimistic about? Where can we be hopeful? What are some rays of sunshine in this region in terms of moving forward in some productive way?
Well, we have allies in the region, chief among them Saudi Arabia, Jordan, that want to help us to defeat the extremists. And we may be seeing a new coalition emerging among some of these states willing to work with Israel. Saudi Arabia and Israel have their interests dovetail at this point on Syria, on Iran, on the Iranian nuclear issue. They've been meeting. Maybe their relationships can get much better and they can solve some of these problems together, including the Palestinian problem. So that's something to be optimistic about.
Thank you so much, Barak, for being with us today and helping us understand a little better the very complicated problems we're facing today in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Barak Barfi, a research fellow for Arab and Islamic Affairs at the New America Foundation. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can find the show in its entirety on our website, kgou.org. where you can also listen to any of our past shows and subscribe to our podcast. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This show was produced by Brian Hardzinski and Sam Dupre, who also wrote all of our digital content. Symphony Swift handles our research. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.